Yeah, we were going to talk about high places. Because it says that Asa did not remove the high places. That's in chapter 15, what is it, verse 15? 15:14. He did not remove the high places. In discussing the high places, let me refer, some of you maybe don't have this NIV study Bible, but there's a note at 1 Kings 3:2. If you go back to 1 Kings 3:2, it says of Solomon, the people were still sacrificing at the high places because the temple had not yet been built for the name of the Lord. Now, since that's the first occurrence of the word here in Kings, I wrote a note at that point which says this: upon entering Canaan, the Israelites often followed the Canaanite custom of locating their altars on high hills, probably on the old Baal sites, although not always, not necessarily so. The question of the legitimacy of Israelite worship at these high places has long been a matter of debate. It is clear that the Israelites were forbidden to take over pagan altars and high places and use them for the worship of the Lord. That's one thing that's very clear. When Israel came into Canaan, they were not to take over pagan altars and simply convert them into places where they would worship the Lord. If you look at Numbers 33:52, you read there, the Lord says, "Drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you, destroy all their carved images and cast idols, demolish all their high places." That's Numbers 33:52. Demolish their high places. So it's clear that Israel was not simply to take over heathen high places. You have similar statements in Deuteronomy 7:5 and Deuteronomy 12:3. That is, to destroy the high places of the Canaanites. So that's one thing that's clear. Another thing that's clear is that altars were to be built only at divinely sanctioned sites. Altars were to be built only at divinely sanctioned sites. Look at Exodus 20:24. Exodus 20:24 is sometimes called the law of the altar. And you have a description there of what the Israelites were to do when they wanted to make an altar. It says, "Make an altar of earth for me and sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, your sheep and goats and your cattle. Wherever I cause my name to be honored, I will come to you and bless you. If you make an altar of stones for me, do not build it with dressed stones, for you will defile it. If you use a tool on it, do not go up to my altar on steps, lest your nakedness be exposed on it." So you have various regulations about how an altar was to be built. The law of the altar seems quite clear to envision the possibility of multiplicity of altars. But when you build an altar, you're to follow these regulations. But you see, in the middle of that section, Deuteronomy 20:24-26, it says, "Wherever I cause my name to be honored, I will come to you and bless you." And it seems that the point of that is, altars were only to be built at places where in some way God had manifested himself. God had caused his name to be honored. In other words, you weren't arbitrarily just to build an altar anywhere you decided you want to build an altar. So it seems that there are those two restrictions at least. You don't take over a heathen altar, and you only build an altar at a divinely sanctioned site. Those things, I think, are clear. But then to get back to this note at 1 Kings 3:2, it is not so clear whether multiplicity of altars was totally forbidden provided the above conditions were met. Opinions of scholars on that are divided. Some say that after the temple was built, there was no legitimate worship or sacrifice at any place but the temple. That comes from a particular way of reading Deuteronomy chapter 12. And some feel that Deuteronomy chapter 12 says when you come into the land, you're ultimately going to build the temple, and the altar there is the only legitimate altar. I don't think that's the proper way to understand what's being said in Deuteronomy chapter 12. It seems to me that the issue in Deuteronomy there is not one of exclusive rights to the temple, but a primacy of the altar at the temple. Not that it's the only legitimate place, but that it's the primary place where sacrifices are made, and certainly the place where the annual festivals were to be held. The males were to go up to Jerusalem three times a year, the major feasts, and they were to be held at Jerusalem. So there was one primary sanctuary where the ark was and where the temple was. But I don't think that necessarily means the exclusion of other altars elsewhere. But as I said, there's some disagreement on that. It's not so clear whether multiplicity of altars was totally forbidden, provided the above conditions were met. It seems, however, that these conditions were not followed. That is, the destroying of the heathen altars and the only building of altars at divinely sanctioned sites. It seems that these conditions were not followed, even in the time of Solomon. And pagan high places were being used for the worship of the Lord. This would eventually lead to religious apostasy, and syncretism was strongly condemned. So it seems that a high place is not necessarily per se something wrong, but that they were so often used in a wrong way that they became a source of the entrance of false worship into Israel. Syncretistic type of worship, sort of combining the worship of Baal with the worship of the Lord. And so that you get these comments about many of the kings, that they didn't tear down the high places. But I don't think you're to conclude from that necessarily that all the high places were wrong. I think it depends on what kind of worship was being carried on there. It depends on whether the site was a divinely sanctioned site. Considerations of that sort.
You had mentioned, too, that the Israelites had also failed to eliminate the Canaanites.
Yeah.
So it seemed that they were probably living in the areas, and it being that those particular sites were destroyed, they probably met.
It's possible. Fellowship. It's possible. Another question. I want to go a bit further with this, with Asa particularly, but go ahead.
When Elijah challenges the Baal,
I wasn't going to go into it, but to make your point, I think that does relate to this.
He finds a broken down altar over there, and apparently there must have been both sides very close.
Yeah. That seems to be a good illustration of the fact that there were altars of the Lord outside of Jerusalem. He rebuilt that altar because it had fallen into disuse. But then it seems to me that the Lord, by answering by fire, really puts his divine sanction on an altar outside of Jerusalem. That is really a legitimate place of worship. In addition, when Elijah flees after that confrontation, he eventually gets to Horeb. And if you look at chapter 19, when the Lord appears to him, look at verse 10. Elijah says, when the Lord says, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He replied, "I have been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, broken down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword." Now, the way he says that seems quite clear that he views that as something bad, that these altars had been broken down, which then seems to suggest there was nothing wrong with altars outside of Jerusalem, provided they weren't on sites of heathen altars and that they were in divinely sanctioned places. But you see, the situation was that the people had so turned away from the Lord that they weren't even using the altars. The altars had broken down, which is something that Elijah laments, which again suggests that altars outside of Jerusalem were not per se wrong. They may be wrong, but not per se. Now, to get back to Asa, 1 Kings 15, 14, you read, he did not remove the high places. Now, I have a note there, in the NIV Study Bible, in which I say the reference here and in 2 Chronicles 15, 17 is to those high places where the Lord was worshipped. There were high places where the Lord was worshipped. In 2 Chronicles 15, 17, you're again talking about Asa. And you read there, although he did not remove the high places from Israel, Asa's heart was fully committed to the Lord. I say you did have high places where the Lord was worshipped. That, I think, is clear in 2 Chronicles 33, 17. It doesn't have to do with Asa, but just notice the phraseology there. In 2 Chronicles 33, 17, you read, the people, however, continued to sacrifice at the high places, but only to the Lord their God. 2 Chronicles 33, 17. The people continued to sacrifice at the high places, but only to the Lord their God. So I think it's clear that sometimes worship to high places was worship to the Lord. Now that worship to the Lord may have been legitimate or may not have been legitimate, depending on whether the altar was at a divinely sanctioned site or not. It still could have been worship to the Lord, but at an unsanctioned site, you see. So there's still confusion there. But I think you must say there is an indication that people worship the Lord sometimes at high places. The reason I bring this up here is 2 Chronicles 15, 17 says, as Kings does, that Asa did not remove the high places. But then look at 2 Chronicles 14, 3. Start at 2. Asa did what was good and right in the eyes of the Lord. He removed the foreign altars and the high places.
James has a different little
twinge
here.
It does? What's it say?
For he removed the altars of the foreign gods and the high places.
Okay. Well, I don't know if that's a lot different. He removed the foreign altars and the high places. Smashed the sacred stones, cut down the Asher pole. It seems like 2 Chronicles 14:3 says, he removed the high places, whereas the other reference in Chronicles, as well as the one in Kings, says he didn't remove the high places. And then you wonder, what do you have? Is that a contradiction? It seems to me that you take the 14:3 verse, when it says Asa removed the high places, as a reference to high places that were centers of pagan Canaanite worship. In other words, you see that there's that distinction. Some of these high places were pagan Canaanite worship. Some of these high places were worship of the Lord. And the distinction is not always clear when you just have a reference to high places. So, when you come to those statements that so-and-so did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, but he didn't remove the high places. I think generally the connotation of high place is bad, because the worship was abused so often. It often was apparently on the sites of heathen worship or heathen altars. And it was a source of the entry into Israel of heathenisms and Israel's worship. But having said that, I don't think that all worship at high places was necessarily wrong. Further questions, comments on that? It's a complex subject.
Yeah, about the Levites, were they given unconditional rights to worship at any altar that God had sanctioned, at any place, at any place?
I would think so, yes.
So it would seem that the Levites being scattered throughout
that's right.
the land
would function in that way.
That's right. Would function in that way. So it seems that
right.
actually ought to have been a place
exactly.
to do what they were supposed to be doing.
Exactly. Otherwise, what's a Levite going to do? If he's going to officiate for a family that wants to bring a sacrifice,
right.
what's he have to do? Go all the way to Jerusalem every time? And if you're living up in Dan in the north, that could be a week's journey or something? I mean, the practicality of it is such. If you're going to say only legitimate worship was at Jerusalem, you're in essence saying the people really didn't have the means to carry out the required rituals that are given in the Pentateuch. And the Levites might have just as well stayed in Jerusalem if they had to go back and forth all the time. Why go back and forth? Just stay there. So the whole thing seems to make more sense if you allow for multiplicity.
And they were given rights to land in order to grow the sheep and earth. Their sheep were, in other words, weren't they supposed to have land so they could provide sacrifices?
The Levites you're talking?
Yeah, they could have animals so they could have sacrifices or something like that.
They were tithes. There may have been some of that, but they also got tithes from the people.
Mm.
Just for their support.
But it seems silly if Israel's a nation of 2 million people or something, there's only one
right.
priest to the temple. I mean, it just seems so silly.
Yeah.
When there's a whole tribe
yeah.
set aside
to just do that. Right. Exactly right. Yes.
If the Second Chronicle 14:3 is talking about falling off, and here it talks about it may be somewhat not falling off.
Yeah.
Why would the writer mention this fact? It seems like, I don't know what the Hebrew convention is there when you say all those. It seems like that also
yeah.
something contrary to
that. Yeah. Well, it may have been worship of the Lord. It may have been worship of the Lord, but on an unsanctioned site. In other words, a high place that somebody just built somewhere because, you know, just arbitrarily built an altar. And even though it was worship to the Lord, if it isn't on a sanctioned site, then it isn't in accordance with the regulations, you might say, of the Pentateuch. I don't know. As you know, it's a hard question, but that's a possibility. Yes?
You mentioned that the sites would be sanctioned. Is there any scriptural material that will tell us how they were sanctioned, whether by prophet or...
Not directly. You know, for example, though, at Bethel, Jacob went there, he had a dream, there's like a theophany with a ladder, and he built an altar then. The Lord appeared to him there. And it seems that probably some sort of theophany like that or something similar would be what is in view there in Exodus when he says that he will cause his name to dwell there. The Lord would manifest himself in some way at a site that was to be a legitimate site for an altar. Yes?
In reference to that 16 and 17, although
yeah.
you did not remove the high place, we were wondering if that was, if that involved means necessarily justification
for necessity. Oh. In the Chronicles, are you?
Yeah, Second Chronicles 15, 17.
And your question was?
Does that thought there, it needs to be taken consistently
first,
it's a
verse like
this,
right? It's a noun.
It's a descriptive expression overall, like give us, you know, the images of high places.
Well, it wouldn't necessarily be. I mean, you know, the above can be used in a wide variety of ways, but it seems in the context that it's that although idea. It seems like a qualification. because what follows is, although he did not remove the high places, his heart was fully committed to the Lord. See, what follows seems to suggest that what goes before...
Well, if it is legitimate to worship the Lord at the high places, then the consistent idea is not necessarily...
Not necessarily, but it depends. You see, there's an ambiguity in the high places. Some high places would be legitimate, some high places would not.
Yeah. So this concessive idea gives us more ambiguity.
Yeah, it seems here that these high places were not legitimate high places. That's what it seems like. Even though if you look at all the data, it seems that there could be high places that were legitimate. Yes?
2 Chronicles 16:8 shows, he said, when Asa heard these words in the prophecy of Azariah, son of Oded, the prophet, he took courage, he removed the successful idol from the whole land of Judah and Benjamin and from the towns he captured in the hills of Ephraim. Was he required only to take them from the southern kingdom, or was he supposed to go into the northern kingdom at that point and do that? So it seems to me that this is saying that these, or the detestable idols, are not the high places. They're not high places.
Well, there seems to, yeah, no, it seems to be that there's a distinction. Of course, those things may have been closely connected, but... You know, when you get these lists, you get the idols and the Asherah poles and the high places and the altars.
And they're separate words.
Yeah,
that's the same.
Yeah.
I see, okay.
Yeah. Well, let's go on. We're talking about Asa, back to 1 Kings 15. As I mentioned, he's described as a good king. 2 Chronicles tells us of a victory Asa had over Zerah the Cushite. Z-E-R-A-H. Zerah the Cushite. That's something not mentioned in Kings. Exactly who Zerah the Cushite is disputed. But he came with a large army and 300 chariots. And in 2 Chronicles 14:9, you read of that. Zerah the Cushite marched against them with a vast army, 300 chariots. Asa went out to meet him. Asa called to the Lord his God. And you read in verse 12, the Lord struck down the Cushites before Asa and Judah. Cushites fled. Asa and his army pursued them and carried off a great deal of plunder. Then they returned to Jerusalem. And what follows in the Chronicles account of Asa's reign is in chapter 15, you have a covenant renewal festival sponsored by Asa. Particularly verse 12 of 2 Chronicles 15, you read, they entered into a covenant to seek the Lord God of their fathers with all their heart and soul. All who would not seek the Lord, the God of Israel, were to be put to death, whether small or great, man or woman. They took an oath to the Lord with loud acclamation, shouting, trumpets and horns. All Judah rejoiced about the oath because they had sworn it wholeheartedly. They sought God eagerly, and he was found by them. So the Lord gave them rest on every side. So there was this reformation in the time of Asa. Yet, in spite of that, you read back in 1 Kings, verse 18 and following, that Asa made an alliance with the heathen king Ben-Hadad of Damascus. The context for that was that Baasha of the northern kingdom attacked Judah and fortified Ramah, which was a site on the border. This is in verse 17 of 1 Kings 15. Ramah was a site on the border between the north and the south. And the purpose of fortifying Ramah was to prevent anyone from leaving or entering the territory of Asa, king of Judah. It's that same situation of Jeroboam's concern. He didn't want people going down to Jerusalem to worship. So he fortified that town and attacks Judah. What does Asa do? He takes the silver and gold of the treasuries of the Lord's temple and sent his officials to Ben-Hadad, son of Tabrim, and son of Hezion, king of Aram, who was ruling in Damascus. Let there be a treaty between me and you, he said, as there was between my father and your father. See, I am sending you a gift of silver and gold. Now break your treaty with Baasha, so he will withdraw from me. Now, of course, you look at a map, you realize that what he was doing was going behind the back, you might say, of the northern kingdom of Baasha, because Syria was to the north and east of the northern kingdom. And he concludes this treaty and pays this silver to Ben-Hadad and asks him to break the alliance that Ben-Hadad had with the north. And Ben-Hadad does that. Verse 20, he agreed with King Asa. And then he attacks the northern kingdom, Ben-Hadad. He conquered Ejon, Dan, Abel, Beth, Maacah, and all Kinnereth. That's by the Sea of Galilee, in addition to Naphtali. When Baasha heard this, he stopped building Ramah and withdrew to Tirzah, which was then the capital of the northern kingdom. Now, something that's not recorded in Kings is that Asa was rebuked for doing that, that is, making that alliance with Ben-Hadad, by Hanani the seer, 2 Chronicles 16, verse 7, which talks about the, prior to that, about the agreement Asa had with Ben-Hadad. And you read in verse 7, at that time, Hanani the seer came to Asa, king of Judah, and said to him, because you relied on the king of Aram and not on the Lord your God, the army of the king of Aram has escaped from your hand. Were not the Cushites and Libyans a mighty army with great numbers of chariots and horsemen? Yet when you relied on the Lord, he delivered them into your hand. That was that previous victory over the Cushites. For the eyes of the Lord range about the earth to strengthen those whose hearts are fully committed to him. You've done a foolish thing. From now on you will be at war. And notice what Asa does. Asa's angry with the seer because of this. So enraged he put him in prison. And you read that because of that, he was afflicted, verse 12, with a disease in his feet. And in his illness, he didn't seek help from the Lord, but only from the physicians, and he died. Now that disease is mentioned in Kings, in 1 Kings 15:23. As for the other events of Asa's reign, all his achievements, all he did, the cities he built, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Judah? In his old age, however, his feet became diseased. And then it says he died. He rested with his father in his burial. Now, he's judged for that. He's condemned by Hanani the seer for this alliance with Ben-Hadad. But I think what you see happening here is something significant, in that this really is the beginning of a long history of struggle between Syria and not only the northern kingdom, but ultimately the southern kingdom too. Between Syria or Aram, which is the same word. Between Syria or Aram and the northern and southern kingdoms. And Asa does something here that really sets an example, which is followed later by Ahaz, for which Isaiah condemns Ahaz. When Ahaz was threatened by the northern kingdom and Syria or Aram together, what's he do? really does the same thing, except now he goes further. He makes an alliance with Tiglath-Pileser of Assyria to seek release from the pressure of Aram and the northern kingdom on Judah. And Isaiah condemns Ahaz for that. But you see, in principle, the same thing is going on here as far as Asa is concerned. Now, Ben-Hadad is also known to us from an inscription that has been found in Syria or Aram. It's called the Milkart Stela, bearing the name of the king of Damascus. This is another volume that is translations of ancient Near Eastern texts. It's called Documents from Ancient Times, page 239. There's a picture of that. With you can pass this around. It's really has a picture of Ben Hadad on it. Okay, let's go a bit further here. That was Rehoboam, Abijah, and Asa. C is the first two dynasties of Israel. We've been going through the first three kings of Judah. Now we go back, pick up the first three or the first two dynasties of Israel, and the first is the dynasty of Jeroboam. 1 Kings 11:26 to 14:20. I have five subpoints there. First is Jeroboam becomes king. Chapter 12, 1 to 20. We've already looked at chapter 12 in connection with Rehoboam and the refusal of the northern tribes to submit to Rehoboam. And you read there in verse 20. When all the Israelites heard that Jeroboam had returned, they sent and called him to the assembly and made him king over all Israel. Only the tribe of Judah remained loyal to the house of David. So that same assembly at Shechem that we looked at in connection with Rehoboam and the request that was made of him to lighten the burden, his refusal, then the Israelites turned to Jeroboam and make him king. So he becomes king there, 1 Kings chapter 12. B is Jeroboam establishes or originates illegal worship, 12:25 to 33. The latter part of the chapter, you read in 25, Jeroboam fortified Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim, lived there. And then he becomes concerned that the people of the north will continue to go to the temple to offer sacrifices. And so he decides he will set up places of worship at Bethel and at Dan. Now Bethel is down toward the border between the northern and the southern kingdoms, be the southern part of Ephraim. And Dan, of course, part of the north. And he set up this calf worship at both those sites. It seems like, and there's some debate about this, and I don't think you can be dogmatic, but it seems like the violation of the Mosaic commandment that is involved here is more the second commandment than the first. That is, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that's heaven above. Probably that more than the first commandment, thou shalt not have any other gods before me. You read, you see in verse 28, he said to the people, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, who brought you out of Egypt. One is set up in Bethel, the other in Dan. That is exactly the same thing that was said in Exodus chapter 34 At the time that the golden calf was set up in the wilderness, while Israel was still at Sinai, let me see if I can find the reference. Exodus 32, verse 4. They said, "These are your gods, O Israel, brought you up out of Egypt." When they shaped that calf. Now, it seems like what was going on with making of these calves, there have been inscriptions found of calves or bulls with images of deities standing on the back of the calf. So that the calf is sort of a pedestal for the deity. And many feel that what was done both in Exodus 32 as well as here by Jeroboam was to make the calf, but not to put the image of the deity on it. So that it was assumed, like in Exodus 32, you find later in the chapter, again it says in verse 8, "These are your gods, O Israel, brought you up out of Egypt." And says it's a feast to Yahweh. That is in verse 5. When Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, "Tomorrow there will be a festival to Yahweh." So it seems that Yahweh was being worshipped in connection with this golden calf. So whether the calf was viewed as a pedestal on which the invisible form of Yahweh was supposed to reside, and they didn't build an actual image of Yahweh, or whether the calf was supposed to be some kind of representation, symbolic form of the power of Yahweh, could be somewhat disputed. But it does seem that the attempt here was to worship Yahweh, but in an illegitimate way. So the violation would be more of the second commandment than the first. But in any case, that's a sin for which Jeroboam is judged, and for which every king in the north that continued that worship is judged, because they caused Israel to walk in the way of the sin of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. Now, I think to go a bit further with this, what you find Jeroboam doing is subordinating worship to politics. And he was concerned for his security of his kingdom and the loyalty of his people. And so he violates clearly that second command, perhaps the first command, but clearly the second, and puts up these illegitimate places of worship. All right, C on your sheet is the prophet from Judah, 1 Kings 13. Question before that. It seems that some of both, probably. I think he did some of both, because you read that in verse 32, he instituted a festival on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the festival held in Judah, but it's at a different time. You see in 33, you read, on the 15th day of the 8th month, the month of his own choosing, he offered sacrifice in the altar he had built at Bethel. So it seems like he sort of pick and chose between things he would adhere to in the Mosaic law and his own revisions of it. Yes?
The Israelites already knew that there was only one God, and how did Jeroboam get to hear the God before the fall?
Significant
God's
then? Yeah. Pardon? I mean, I'm just saying, by the very mention of the fact that God is a plural.
You see, there's some ambiguity there, because Elohim is always plural. It's translated singular when it's clear that it's the God of Israel that's in view by the use of the term. It's translated plural when it's references to heathen deities. So
But it's just funny, yeah. Because I say, here are your gods.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's not what it says here. If he took it as a political policy.
If he took it as
a political policy to revenge it.
Now, I'm not sure whether you'd have to look at the use of that expression in Exodus and here, and I think it occurs some other places. Whether there's any reason why it couldn't be translated, "This is your God," instead of "These are your gods," I'm not sure. It may be that the form "these," "aleph," is plural, rather than "this," singular, which would have a plural modifier. But then you could say that the plural modifier is because the noun is plural, but that there's a singular concept involved, if it is really Yahweh that's in view. So, again, there's some ambiguity there because of the nature of the Hebrew term.
I think maybe if we're translating it, I mean, like I said, the idiom has been lost somehow.
It's possible.
Exactly, yeah.
All right. C is the prophet from Judah, 1 Kings 13. Very interesting chapter. There's this unnamed prophet. He's called a man of God out of Judah. He goes to Bethel. Jeroboam's standing there sacrificing. And he condemns Jeroboam for building that altar. And in the process of doing that, he says that a child named Josiah of the house of David will one day burn the bones of these illegitimate priests that Jeroboam had secured to sacrifice there on that altar at Bethel. Now, that's a remarkable prophecy because Josiah is not a ruler for about 300 years after this time. We're at 931. Josiah was 620s. So you're about 300 years before the time of Josiah. You have the statement that Josiah will come and destroy that altar and burn the bones of the priests on it. And you find, you look in the time of Josiah, that happened in the reign of Josiah. So you have a remarkable prophecy. It's interesting, just as sort of an aside, that prophecy assumes the continuation of the Davidic dynasty for that long period of time. Whereas in the Northern Kingdom, you have four unconnected dynasties plus several individual kings who didn't establish dynasties that existed during the period of the time of the Northern Kingdom. You didn't have a consistent line in the north. This prophecy implies there will be, of course, in the south. Of course, that's consistent with the promise to David anyway. But in connection with that prophecy, which is long-term, he gives us a short-term prophecy. And in verse 3, you read, "The same day the man of God gave a sign. This is the sign the Lord has declared. The altar will be split apart and ashes on it will be poured out." And you read in verse 5, "The altar was split apart and its ashes poured out according to the sign given by the man of God by the word of the Lord." So you have a long-range prophecy that is confirmed or authenticated by a short-term prophecy that was fulfilled right on the very day as these people watched. In the meantime, Jeroboam stretches out his hand, this is verse 4, and says, "Seize this prophet." And when he stretches his hand out, it shrivels and he can't pull it back. And so he says in verse 6, "Intercede with the Lord your God, pray for me that my hand may be restored." And the man of God interceded with the Lord, and the king's hand was restored, and it became as it was before. So there you again have another authentication of the fact that the Lord was working and speaking through this man of God out of Judah. Then Jeroboam invites this prophet to go home and eat with him. And the prophet says he can't do it. Verse 9, he says, I was commanded by the word of the Lord, you must not eat bread or drink water or return by the way you came. And so he starts home a different way. And there you read later in the chapter that he meets an old prophet who tells him, I'm also a prophet. And an angel said to me, bring him back with you to your house so that he may eat bread and drink water. That's verse 18. But he lied to him. But the man of God went with him, drank in his house, and then while they're sitting at the table, the word of the Lord comes to that prophet. And the word of the Lord was a message of judgment for him for his disobedience. Verse 21, this is what the Lord says. You have defied the word of the Lord, have not kept the command of the Lord your God. You came back and ate bread, drank water in the place where he told you not to eat or to drink. Therefore, your body will not be buried in the tomb of your fathers. In other words, he's going to come to some kind of unusual death, not a normal death. And as he proceeds further on his journey, he's met by a lion and killed. And the interesting thing is that the lion stands there by the body with the donkey, and he doesn't attack the donkey, he doesn't mutilate the body. There are clearly indications that there are miraculous things going on here. But it's a sad story because here was this prophet who came and proclaimed the word of the Lord against that altar, gave this marvelous prophecy, and yet was not completely obedient. And even though the Lord had told him not to do something, he did do it. And then the Lord judged him. Now, I think a lot of that was for the benefit of Jeroboam. He was to see the power of the word of the Lord at work. But you read at the end of the chapter, verse 33, even after this, Jeroboam did not change his evil ways. But once more appointed priests for the high places from all sorts of people. Anyone who wanted to become a priest, he consecrated for the high place. See, we're over time. We better stop. Was there a question or comment? Yeah.
The lion, the prophet, this is what he should have been the one to get
from some judgment.
That's where the old man he gives up.
And then, of course, the word of the Lord comes to him again. And says that he's going to be a prophet. He's going to make the God.
Yeah, well, I think you have to make a distinction between a good man and a true prophet. They're not necessarily the same thing. A bad man can also be a true prophet. In other words, I think prophecy is more a function. When the word of the Lord comes on, like Balaam prophesied, it was a heathen soothsayer. In this case, this old prophet, he lied, but when the word of the Lord came, he performed a prophetic function. Well, I think he was, but I think at this point he certainly whatever his personal interest was in having this man with him, it seems like a selfish kind of thing that caused him to do something very wrong.
You know, what's interesting too is that it really sets off kind of a McConville idea in saying too that even the prophets were crummy. You know what I'm saying? They may be right, but they're crummy too.
It's interesting.
One of the first times you can really see what's going on here. Yeah. This is the Northern Kingdom, and this is what happened, and look how crummy the prophets were.
List is
$29.95.
$11.95.
I know. That's what I'm amazed at. Certainly not the first character who doesn't get judged in the